from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Listen to the way teens talk, and you'll hear it. Hooking up, friends with benefits, ubiquitous slang in an era of teen sex that some believe has become alarmingly casual, nonchalant, even meaningless. It's no big deal, some teens say. Oral sex isn't even sex, say others. But one recent teen sex scandal at Milton Academy, a Tony, Massachusetts prep school, has parents and experts worried about just how jaded kids have become. The school expelled 5 male students after they received oral sex in the boys' locker room from a 15-year-old female sophomore, allegedly as a birthday gift for one of the boys. Oral sex as a birthday present, multiple partners, a sex-saturated media culture. Some now charge that boomers, the generation that celebrated sexual liberation, have raised a generation of teens for whom sex and intimacy mean nothing, that it's just something to do. The causes and consequences of so many casual, careless, even cold teen attitudes about sex reach far and wide. Tonight on Point, charges of an epidemic of meaningless teen sex and the cost to a society that celebrates sex without significance. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you see an epidemic of meaningless teen sex in America today? In a time when hooking up can mean almost anything and everything, when sex is everywhere, is it a surprise that teens may be emotionally disengaged from the ultimate act of intimacy? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight in the studio is Mark O'Connell, psychologist and instructor at Harvard Medical School and author of The Good Father on Men, Masculinity, and Life in the Family. His recent essay in the Boston Globe was headlined The Epidemic of Meaningless Teen Sex. Mark O'Connell, thanks for being with us tonight.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So what are you talking about when you talk about an epidemic of meaningless teen sex?
Well, we're talking about a group of kids, by no means all, but to a degree that's disturbing very, very many, who are talking about sex in a way that's very different from, I think, how we thought about it in our generation, where part of sex was something about excitement, flirtation, worry, anxiety, fear, and within all of that, an effort that people had to kind of struggle with themselves, to struggle with who they were as they were growing up, to struggle with who another actual person was, and to negotiate this in a real and meaningful way. We're talking about kids who really aren't experiencing sex in the same way. By way of thinking about how kids talk about this, I thought about a quasi-anecdote. 15 years ago, when I'd first meet a kid, we'd get together and we'd spend a few sessions talking about who each other were.
When you'd meet them as a psychologist.
As a psychologist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, eventually we'd talk about school, we'd talk about friends, but we'd get around to the question, or I'd try to get around to the question, so what about sex? And there would be blushing and there would be anxiety and there'd be worry, but eventually we'd find a way to talk about this really important thing. These days, often when I ask that question, I get a look that is almost like, well, okay, sex, let's talk about sex, but are you going to ask me about brushing my teeth next? It's
no big deal.
No big deal, as hygienic as that.
You say that that the sexual freedom and permissiveness of the boomers once reveled in, has undergone an unexpected transformation. How do you describe the evolution there?
Well, I think that this is one of the huge factors that's causing this issue within kids. And I think, you know, if you think about the evolution of sexuality over the last 40 years, from the free love of the 60s and 70s through the disco generation, through what we see now, there's been a gradual evolution of a kind of sexual permissiveness from a sexuality in which, at least to some degree, love, feeling, and connection were still part of the culture, to one in which sexuality is, I'll use the word, increasingly pornographic. And by that, I'm not only referring to the explicit pornography that we see on the internet and in films, but I'm talking about a quality of sexuality that pervades our culture in beer ads and MTV videos and all manner of sexual images in which it is predominantly, I think, male-created. It is empty. It is about all things go at any time and in any way, and in which it's no big deal. It's just about something to do rather than something meaningful.
This was brought sharply to light here locally in a story that had a lot of national play as well at this prep school where a 15-year-old girl was giving oral sex to 5 boys in the locker room, and the words that that were floating around this were mistake, that this was a mistake, and, mm-hmm. and that this was a matter of consent. And you say both these words are wrong. It's kind of an indicator of a misperception about what's going on.
I think so, and I think that for two reasons. I mean, one, I think that the whole notion that we have that a 15-year-old is, A, capable of the kind of informed consent. I mean, I'm talking about legal consent, but I'm talking about really a psychological consent where you really understand the down-the-road consequences of what you're doing is a mistaken view of kids. I mean, kids are still growing up, and I think that part of what's happening is an issue that's larger than sex, where as adults, as parents, as authority figures, we have somehow lost the ability to know how to say no to kids, to know how to create structures for kids. And the use of the word consent allows a kid a certain kind of precocious maturity that kids not only psychologically don't have, but even literally neurologically don't have.
In this case, the idea that this young girl consented to what was going on, and you're saying it doesn't really apply, it's misapplied.
I believe that. I also think in this case, and I'm not speaking specifically about this case, but so often I think we adults look at situations like this and assume an act of volition. And at least clinically in my experience, again, not talking about Milton, but in my experience with situations like this, there are so often aspects of people's histories involved that are traumatic or painful or difficult, where a kid is finding themselves in a situation where they're acting something out that they simply don't have the kind of control over that we give them. And it's this way that we've made kids little adults in a way that I think is well beyond their time and well beyond their ability.
Little adults and maybe of a different stripe. You say all this is leaving young Americans in their sex lives cut off from intimacy, tenderness, connection. You're a psychologist. What kind of long-term implications do you see here?
Well, I worry a lot about this. I see major long-term implications for the kids who are already in this kind of situation, and I also worry about it in terms of future generations. I mean, you know, one way this could go is that we might see a pendulum swing back the other way, and I know you're having some people from an abstinence movement on later, which I think is a reflection of what, in certain ways, is already beginning to happen. But I don't know which way this is going to go. And I also believe that for the kids who are already are structured in their sexuality around this way, I think I have great worries for them. I mean, these things can change, but you know, one of the great rules in life that you learn as a psychologist is that over time, people only change a little. A little goes a long way.
You lay down patterns of behavior early on.
That make their way into marriages. And you know, for example, you know, you think about the again, use the word epidemic of people who are dissatisfied with their marriages, and we're talking about a group of kids now who already have expectations about what sex should be that are completely unrealistic. And how is that going to play in 30, 40 years of a marriage?
I want to look a little more closely into that, Mark O'Connell. Please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation tonight from Providence, Rhode Island, Lynn Ponton. She's a professor of psychiatry at the University of California at San Francisco. She's author of The Sex Lives of Teenagers, Revealing the Secret World of Adolescent Boys and Girls. Lynn Ponton, thanks for being with us tonight.
It's a pleasure to join you. I've been listening and enjoying the conversation.
I wish that I'm sure you've got a lot of insights yourself, but I wish you start out with some kind of factual filling in of the mural here, because I think to Americans of a certain age, what's going on is invisible and really kind of hard to understand. What is the terrain of teenage sexuality today, Lynn Ponton? What's it look like?
Well, I think there are five or six points that would be helpful and really add to what Mark is saying. First, I think to keep in mind that the sexuality in the media is much more prominent than it was 10 years ago. So the images that Mark's described are there, and that aspect of the sexual culture is much more explicit. But there are a couple of other things that indicate that there's actually quite a bit of sexual restriction in the United States. And one of those are the very restrictive sexual gender roles. Our sexual culture is actually largely a restrictive one with a very liberal media. And I think that's hard for parents to grasp, but we have very limited gender roles. We have a double standard. We have a lot of the things that they have even in Middle Eastern cultures. So I think it's surprising it's not completely a liberal sexual culture. In fact, quite the contrary.
So you see a liberal media and sexual restriction, and yet your book is focused on this secret world. I mean, tell us what's going on. We hear that oral sex is much more common than it was a generation earlier.
Oral sex, the studies actually don't indicate that. Oral sex, there's a lot more exposure in the media. I think we also have to take into account adult attitudes about oral sex after Clinton's statements and interaction around it, because that did change things.
The idea that wasn't really sex.
That's right. And when an adult says that, and it's printed in many papers, and kids listen to this online. You know, I was standing over the shoulders of three or four teenagers who watched on their computer that whole story come up online, and they listen and they hear what we say. So that's a factor. But, you know, with respect to overall sexual behavior, adolescent sexual intercourse, the onset of that is 16 years of age, and it is held at that figure for more than 10 years.
Are you saying sexual behavior has not, in fact, changed, that it's just a media creation?
Not completely, no. I think there are some changes. I do believe that kids are having oral sex at an earlier age. I think to call it an epidemic is really very much overstepping the situation. And I think we have to look at why they're having oral sex. There is meaning for them in oral sex. It's not the meaning that Mark was talking about, which is intimacy, you know, far from it. Adolescent girls are giving 97% of oral sex, you know, receiving less than 3% of oral sex. So that ties in with the gender roles. It also ties in with limited sexual education in our country. There's been very limited sexual education for the last 8 years. 49 states now take abstinence-only money and limit their sexual education.
Lynn Potten, please stand by. Mark O'Connell, there's a lot more we want to get into here. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the charge of an epidemic of meaningless teen sex in America today, and you can join this conversation. When sex is everywhere, on TV, on the web, in the music, is it any wonder that teens don't see it, may not see it, as special? And has one generation's sexual liberation turned into another's sexual ennui? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the charge of an epidemic of meaningless teen sex in America today, about young Americans hooking up so casually that sex is drained of meaning, of intimacy, of emotional significance. I'm joined tonight by Mark O'Connell. He's a psychologist and instructor at Harvard Medical School, author of The Good Father, and by Lynn Potten, professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, author of The Sex Lives of Teenagers. You can join our conversation as well. Are you plugged in or in denial about the casual prevalence among teens of oral sex, multiple partners, easy hookups? And teens, what's going on sexually in your social circle? Is it good? Is it okay? Is it bad? Is it meaningless? And parents, do you even know what's going on? Have you abdicated oversight of your teen's sex lives? What's your message to your teen? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mark O'Connell, Lynn Potten's laying out a lot of facets of this here, but among the things she's saying is that she's not so sure that the sexual behavior has changed. How do you see that?
I disagree. I think it has changed. I think what Lynn is saying that I do very much agree with is that the statistics show that there is not a major league increase in the amount of sex that kids are having, although it does suggest, I think, as she mentioned, that kids are having sex at an earlier age. I think what we're talking about, though, when we're talking about an epidemic, is not the amount of sex that kids are having, but the quality of it and what it means. And that's a much more subjective, qualitative mm-hmm. phenomena. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, let's talk, for example, about, and I'll be very interested to hear what Lynn thinks about this, but let's talk about oral sex mm-hmm. and the meaning of oral sex for kids. Apart from the question of whether kids are having more oral sex or not, what is the phenomena of oral sex for kids, and why has it become so popular? And, you know, obviously part of that is a historical piece that I think with the onset of the AIDS epidemic, people started to think that this was a safer way to have sex. But I think that there's...
We should clarify, it is not necessarily.
Which is right. But I think there's another and deeper meaning in terms of what sex means to people, which I think is what we're talking about here today. I don't remember how many of you remember the movie Pretty Woman. But when
Richard Gere and
Julia Roberts, mm-hmm. and when they're talking about having sex, she says to him essentially, well, I'll have oral sex with you, but I won't kiss you. And it's a fascinating line. And I think, in my mind,
I.e., the intimacy is up by the face.
Exactly. I think mm-hmm. that's exactly what we're talking about here. And there's a way that we have come to talk about sex, and this is part of this pornographic sexuality that I'm talking about, mm-hmm. in such clinical, genital, functional, hygienic terms that certain sex acts that were shocking a long time ago, or not even that long ago to people, are not so much anymore. But what's incredibly complicated are things like actually looking in somebody's eyes when you're having sex. And a kiss, you do that. you don't during oral sex. And I think that's part of what's happening, where the problem doesn't lie so much in the increase in sex, it lies in the intimate disconnection that's occurring in sexual relationships.
So out with the romance and in with something else. Lynn Potten, I want to get your response to that, but before I do, I want to begin to bring our callers in. A lot are waiting to join the conversation. And right now, Ted is calling from Attleboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Ted. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thanks, Ted. What's on your mind?
Well, I was interested, 20 years old, and I was interested to hear adults talking about this because, you know, I'm a sophomore in college, and I got out of high school 2 years ago. When I was in high school, I was surprised by how, you know, prevalent sex was, generally speaking, especially oral sex. And I want to shed a little light on what Lynn was talking about, because I think even if, you know, this is how it is with teenagers, even if people aren't having it, they're thinking about it differently, you know, and oral sex, getting head is what it's called, because it's almost always girls to guys, like it was at Milton.
Yeah.
And it's like an extension of making out, of kissing, like you were just saying. It's sex maybe still has some of its mystique, but oral sex just is almost meaningless.
And Ted, let me ask you, you're 20. You've just come through the teen years that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Do you buy the idea that there's a kind of vacuum of meaning there, or is this just, you know, adults of a different generation not getting it?
Well, you know, maybe I'm an old soul, but I agree with you. I think it's just a change in the way society looks at things like this, and I think just the way teenagers see it, it is drained of meaning. Like the media, I think the media is just such a huge part of it. I know it's a classic refrain.
Because it's so sex-saturated.
Exactly, sex. I mean, the OC is one of the most popular shows with kids, and almost every other week now you have a different set of characters hooking up, switching partners, doing, you know, a lot of times they're having sex with all different people, you know, so there's an expectation there that's become very important. You know, I think everyone feels the pressure to almost get on with it, you know, to get into the, you know, the upper levels of, you know, sexual behavior.
Right. Ted, stick with us for a second. I want to turn to Lynn Potten and get her thoughts on this. Lynn, Ted is just been through this exactly the years we're talking about, and he says oral sex is just making out.
Well, I wouldn't say that he said that exactly, Tom. I think
we can go back to him if you like, but I think it's pretty close.
One perspective on it. Couple of things I think are interesting about it. Oral sex itself has many different meanings, really, to teenagers. One is it increases status and popularity. And that's why adolescent girls engage in it, and also because they want boys to like them. So when we think about the most successful programs to really target increasing girls' intimacy, and how do you do that, and how do you decrease rates of oral sex with girls? There's different factors with boys. One of the things you do is teach girls about how to orgasm themselves. So you really provide that type of course so that they can achieve sexual pleasure without really engaging in it vicariously for boys. So that means more comprehensive sexual education.
So you're saying your prescription is not pulling back from this realm, but actually pushing girls further into it?
And not pushing girls further into it, Tom, at all. In fact, from my perspective, I don't think girls under 16 should be engaging in oral sex, giving oral sex to boys, because there are studies that indicate that girls see it as forced sex when they're forced to do that. But greater education for girls about their biology. So that's one of the things that would make a very big difference. Then second, Mark talked about intimacy. The other factor that increases girls' control are really encounter groups where they work to learn about intimacy, self-esteem, how to talk to boys. You know, Mark mentioned looking into each other's eyes. That's a very important factor there. The last thing I'd say about oral sex was very conspicuous, high rates in the 50s and 60s, before birth control. This isn't the first time we've seen it.
Right.
And even then, the media was much stricter. But what do these two periods have in common? Strict gender roles for women. And when you have women restricted in this way, that very much increases the rates of oral sex where women are giving it out. And I think we really have to look at a culture where women are treated as objects, and the media does that and encourages this position.
Ted, let me ask you first. What do you think? Lynn saying girls are objects. They really need here is empowerment.
Well, I mean, first of all, I would like to say I like to think I'm an enlightened guy, and, you know, I have a lot of friends who are girls, and I've dated a lot of girls,
mm-hmm.
And tried to treat them right and everything. But I do think she's on to a good point, which is that girls get stuck because there's a lot of pressure on them to give oral sex. But once they often get labeled as sluts. So they're damned if they do and damned if they don't. You know, they don't. I think it can be a very bad situation that girls can get into where they really have don't have a good choice to make.
So a kind of popularity, but not necessarily the popularity or the reputation with it that you'd like to have. Ted, thanks very much for your call. I appreciate your calling in. Mark O'Connell, to me, Lynn Ponton's at the top level being counterintuitive here, but I'm quickly hearing what she's saying. But she's saying empowerment is the answer, not withdrawal here exactly, but empowerment for girls.
I think she's right. It's such an interesting conversation because I think she and I, in certain ways, are talking about the same thing, but in ways that seem different at times and from different angles. And here's one way that I understand that. I think we can't talk about this phenomena without talking about the difference between men and women and boys and girls and how different an experience this is, even within the same general thread of meaninglessness and disconnection for boys and for girls. And I think one of the things that Lynn is talking about is, you know, some girls talk to me about ways in which things like hooking up are actually quite positive for them because they feel some sense of sexual agency in the hooking up.
That is actually power in a way.
That is empowering. And I think one of the things that is incredibly important and complicated for girls and women to do in the course of their sexual development is to develop that sense of agency.
Mm-hmm.
I think
I'm a full party to this.
I'm a full party to this. This is my body. It's my sexuality. And I think it's
And yet that's not the dynamic we're hearing described.
No. And I think part of it is that it's very difficult in this culture, and Lynn referred to this earlier where she was talking about the male-oriented culture. The images of sexuality out there are, I believe, extraordinarily male-dominated.
Mm.
It is of a male sexuality more than a female sexuality, and as a girl, how do you find your own sexual self within that culture? I think the one dilemma that I would be interested in getting Lynn's feedback about, just to tweak this a bit, is there a way, when we're talking about giving girls a sense of agency, that we're continuing that process of giving them certain aspects of a male-oriented vision of sexuality? And how do we make room for girls within this culture to have a vision of sexuality that, you know, these differences are not absolute, but they're relative, that's more predominantly female?
Lynn Ponton, what do you say?
Well, I think I appreciate Mark's comments, and I agree that though it is, in some sense, a debate, there are many similarities in our positions. I really feel strongly about girls being educated about their bodies, and when you have limited sexual education, you really don't have that opportunity. So that means that girls meet together in groups and talk about their sexual development, that they're taught about orgasm and self-pleasure, because boys learn easily and in many ways automatically in this culture about how to masturbate. Girls do not.
Are boys more aggressive today in their sexual relations than they were in previous generations, Lynn Ponton?
I would say no to the aggression, but yes, in some ways, to being more callous about it, at least in terms of the front that they put on. When you really ask them and you work with them over time, you found out that they too, like Ted, are shocked about their own attitudes or what they pretend to. So I don't think they're necessarily more aggressive. There's always been a high rate of forced sex.
Mm.
And that's something we're really working to counter. The strong gender roles don't help with that because they don't empower girls, and they really give boys the wrong perspective.
And what about the way teens socialize today? I mean, I've seen dating, old-fashioned dating, seem to kind of go by the boards in favor of, you know, groups going out, and parents of a different generation imagine they're just going off to picnic. But, you know, then they end up at somebody's house, and we've got all kinds of pairing off and hooking up. Has the manner of socializing changed sexual relations, Lynn?
Tom, actually, the group dating, if it was supervised, would be excellent. Because cultures that really provide support for their youth, for example, Brazil has a strong culture where kids date in groups, they're supervised, and it's a way they can become friends. What you're talking about are the unsupervised parties and large groups of kids where they hook up. That's a problem, but we need to provide supervision and I think more conversations with our kids about sex.
Mark, if I may, supervised group outings of teens doesn't seem to be really what we're talking about here. It's the other thing that Lynn describes.
Right, right.
And that sounds to me like a new format.
Yeah, I think, though, if I might say something about the notion of supervision, I mean, I hope at some point today we'll also talk about what will help this. I mean, if we're agreed yeah. that kids are struggling with the whole matter of meaninglessness and sexuality. And what I like in terms of what Lynn is saying about supervision is I do think that there is an aspect of this that is very much about a generation that's unsupervised, that's without a certain kind of authority, without a certain kind of structure. And it is a series of issues that we see not only in the domain of sexuality, but I think in all manner of ways, kids' ambition, kids' sense of becoming an adult, kids' sense of agency. And I think
you mean there's not enough, they can't do enough modeling because the parents are simply away, or this generation of parents is not delivering enough in terms of instruction?
It's not just a matter of being away. There was an article in the Boston Globe today about how to talk to your kids about sex. And I was just really struck in reading this article that in two pages, I did not notice a single mention of how to say no to your kids, about how to talk to when not to do it, how mm-hmm. not to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think that, to go back to this matter of supervision, I think one of the things that we've got to talk about is how we create a somewhat safer space for kids to grow up so that their bodies can catch up with their minds.
I want to get a quick call here. Eric's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yeah, this is a great conversation. I really appreciate you having this on. I just had two comments. I actually, very quickly, I've taught in the past a sexuality class in our church,
mm-hmm.
and it, without going into a lot of detail, explores five different aspects of sexuality. And one of the main aspects of the class is to talk about sexualization and how we in our culture sexualize just about everything, and the guests have talked about how
to help them understand what's going on. Think about the context that they're living in there.
Right, and mm-hmm. we see this in our images, and, mm-hmm. and they actually, one of the exercises is they build a collage out of magazines that could be from Time magazine all the way to Vogue, and it's surprising to the kids that they see when they build these collages that the vast majority of the pictures, the images that they come up with are incredibly driven toward the male population versus the women,
mm-hmm.
disproportionately.
Mm-hmm.
The other quick thing that I want to mention is that I think it's important through this mechanism that we have a safe and almost a curriculum-like attitude toward how we talk to our kids about sex and sexuality, that it's not just about oral sex or how babies are made, or the things that you get in school.
You mean it's not just about the plumbing?
Exactly. It's not the plumbing. There's so many more aspects of that, and especially for girls, I think, they get a better sense that there's a whole panorama of ideas that, in the end, help them build their self-esteem and at least awareness.
Eric, let me ask you, when you teach this class in your church, do you sense that these teens are very different than your generation was, than you were?
I don't get that sense. I don't get that sense. What I get is that they are shy about talking about it, particularly with adults in the room, but we foster a safe environment.
Yeah, it's still pretty tough. They're at church and you're a parent.
Correct, right. but at the same time, you know, they get the idea that we are there really just to present facts. We're not there to present opinions or anything other than be there as a sounding board to answer questions and guide them through
yep.
understanding these different things. So I wanted to get some comment maybe from your guests about this whole idea of exposing our kids to various aspects of what sexuality is so that they become more aware and more
self-confident. We've got it, and we'll go right to it, Eric, and we thank you very much for your call. We're going to hear just after the upcoming break from the abstinence camp here. But Lynn Ponton, first to you. Eric says you've got to tell your kids that it's not just about plumbing, about the physical interaction. You've got to speak to the other levels of sexual relationship. Does that make your screen as well?
I couldn't agree more with Eric because I really think I've done 25 years of sexual education with groups of teenagers and large groups, too. And they respond very much also to personal vignettes and stories of other kids. They identify with them. You really want to foster open questioning, as he was talking about. Lots of things really make a difference, and an adult has to learn some of the HIP language to really be able to talk about it. And all of those things, I think, make kids feel comfortable.
Got to stand up and engage here. Lynn Pont and Mark O'Connell, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the charge of an epidemic of meaningless teen sex in America today. You can join the conversation if teen sex has become not just dangerous but meaningless. Is that an argument for abstinence? We'll talk about that. Can sexual freedom and teen permissiveness coexist with meaningful sex? How? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about young Americans, teens, hooking up so casually that sex is drained of meaning, of intimacy, of emotional significance, about the charge of an epidemic of meaningless teen sex in America today. You can join the conversation. Has one generation's sexual liberation turned into another's sexual ennui? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I've been joined tonight by Lynn Ponton. She's professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, author of The Sex Lives of Teenagers, and Mark O'Connell, psychologist and instructor at the Harvard Medical School, author of The Good Father. We're joined right now from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, by Denny Patton. He is founder and president of Silver Ring Thing. It's a national sexual abstinence program that uses comedy and music videos and youth outreach to promote abstinence. Denny Patton, thanks for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
We've heard about your movement and the work it does. I'd love to get you to chime in. I know you've been listening a bit. When you preach abstinence, is it exactly to avoid the phenomena that's on the table here tonight of meaninglessness in sexual relationships?
Well, yes, and first of all, we don't preach it. We offer it to students for a choice.
Fair enough.
But, yes, as a matter of fact, we just had an entire group flown over from London by the BBC. Actually, the BBC is going to air the broadcast because they were finding that these students were having such meaningless sex in London that church offered an idea called the Romance Academy for any students that would be willing to wait 5 months and be abstinent for 5 months so that they could teach them how to have a relationship, how to have a relationship with one another, because it was just so ugly in the community. And so they flew these kids over to our program in Florida, and 8 of the students actually put on a ring. They brought 11. They had 12, but one got arrested before he came.
And so, putting on a ring means?
Waiting till you're married to have sex.
And when you bring this message to kids, do you bring it as a matter of biblical teaching or as a matter of human fulfillment or both?
Actually, it is both. We offer a program that shows where faith fits into the critical decision of wedding to your married to have sex. We also offer a seminar as well on how to make an abstinence decision but without faith being the centerpiece.
And what kind of response do you find?
We have 75% of the students who come to our program make the decision to put on the ring.
That means that your message gets to them. What do they tell you about why they're doing it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's an article out in the U.S. News and World Reports, a special edition, The Mystery of the Teenage Years. I don't know if you've seen it on the newsstands. And the very lead article says, the next great generation, ? And they're pointing out that they believe we might have the next great generation of young people, this Y generation, this millennial generation, mm-hmm. because of how they've been behaving differently than these past generations. And it made me think that when was the last great generation? And it drew me back all the way to World War II, which is, 60 years back. And so I've been working with teenagers for 35 years now, and I have to say this generation is different, and they are making choices that past generations were not capable or interested in making.
Lynn Ponton, what do you think about abstinence as a response to the sort of generational profile we're hearing tonight?
Well, Tom, I have some very serious concerns about programs that offer only abstinence only. as a form of education about sexuality. First, there's a significant rebound from those programs 6 to 12 months out.
Rebound meaning what?
Meaning
that
teenagers engage in unprotected sexual intercourse. Even more so, when you look at kids that have been in comprehensive sexual education, there's a steady accrument of knowledge. They really gradually learn. They have high condom use. When you look at the abstinent-only programs, they're not fully educated about condom use, and you really see a rebound effect where the kids have unprotected sexual intercourse, not 6 to 12 months out of the program.
But is this a way to communicate or to try to communicate to young people that there's something really special here, that this is not just a casual thing, that there's more depth and meaning to this?
Tom, I am all for communicating intimacy as one of the meanings of sex and really talking comprehensively about sexuality, but inflicting faith-based single and solely restrictive ideas on our youth is not only is it marginal in terms of ideas, but it really is unhealthy because you see this rebound, you see higher rates of unprotected intercourse, and it gives kids limited thinking in this area. Another criticism of the programs is what do they say about gay youth when you're putting a ring on to wait till you're married? Well, I guess they're educating fully about the gay transgender group too, but that's not the case.
Denny, what do you say to that line of critique?
Well, there was a lot of points that I think she misrepresented, obviously. First of all, the 6 to 12 months. The only real decent study out there was that the absence-only, some organizations that teach absence-only delay at 18 months. So we have that study from Columbia University of 90,000 students. Mm-hmm. But go to the gay piece. We get a lot of questions from gay and lesbian individuals about what should they do as far as putting on the ring, and we encourage them to do that.
Because, to wait until when?
Well, we don't take that issue on. What we take on is the issue of a kid getting a sexually transmitted disease, and we know that that's directly linked to the onset of sexual activity and also the number of partners a person has in a lifetime.
But when you have a gay person put on the ring, does it mean for life in your structure?
No. What I would say their mm-hmm. goal in this situation would be to wait and delay sexual activity to an age later and then deal with the marriage issues that come up in their lives. In other words, that's not our issue. We just simply say we want to protect young people from getting a sexually transmitted disease, and most everybody that looks at the information objectively would say that abstinence is clearly the best way to protect yourself. So I simply say that and want to help them do that for the period of time that they can actually wear the ring.
Mark O'Connell, you describe what you see as a kind of chasm of meaning around sex. And then Denny says, well, we'll respond to that with a call to abstinence. Lynn says, no, you need more education, you need more understanding. Where do you come down here?
Well, let me try to talk about this as I understand it, which is on a kind of underlying level through all of this. I mean, I think people have a right to make their own individual choices about whether it's sexual preference, about whether it's abstinence. But I think one of the things that's really interesting in this conversation is that each one of us, Lynn, Denny, and myself, have talked in different ways about the establishment of limits of no, and whether that's by way of abstinence, whether that's by way of supervision, whether that's by way of parents actually saying to their kid, you know, we think 14 years old is too young to have oral sex. I mean, I think we're all talking about establishing some kind of no in this. And let me speak for a minute about why I think that that's at the heart of this issue. What happens when kids are overstimulated and overwhelmed by the sexual culture that's around them? I mean, if you think back to when we were kids and you first thought about a kiss or a naked body or how exciting that was and how overwhelming it was. You know,
the Sears catalog was a big deal.
It was a big deal. And when you were 13, 14 years old, just getting your mind around that was a major league piece of work. So now we're talking about a generation of kids that isn't looking at a Sears catalog.
It's the Victoria's Secret catalog in the mailbox.
They're looking at Victoria's Secret. They're also looking at, you know, Jenny Met Sally on the Internet. And, you know, I think what we're talking about is a culture of kids, a generation of kids that is just getting loaded with information and then stimulation way beyond what they can manage. You know, you're ready to have sex, biologically long before you're ready to have a sexual relationship, just as you're ready to have a kid biologically long before you're ready to be a father or a mother. And I think what we're all talking about is, how do you create room for kids' minds to catch up with their bodies? Because kids' bodies develop faster than their minds.
And you're saying no is part of that formula.
And whatever aspect of no your personal preference is, whether it's abstinence, whether it's parental authority, whether it's creating a buffer in our culture, whether it's supervision, these are all elements, I think, of the ultimate solution, which is creating a safer place for kids to grow up.
Easy to say, but harder to deliver on. Brenda's calling from Boston. Hi, Brenda. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thanks, Brenda.
I just wanted to chime in just to say, you know, I started having sex when I was 15.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people always had oral sex. But, you know, being a sexually active teen and performing oral sex is, to me, it's a different situation. Because to me, there were those girls that gave oral sex, and most of them were girls with incredibly low self-esteem.
So you're not putting yourself in that. When you say 15 years and sex, you're talking about intercourse, not just oral sex.
Exactly. Like, it just seems like a different issue to me, because the girls that were just strictly performing oral sex, like, for instance, what happened at Milton Academy, I mean, if that was five guys, it's a little bit different. But,
yep.
I mean, it was really a self-esteem issue.
And did you feel the meaninglessness envelope that we're talking about tonight at age 15 with full-on sex, Brenda, or not?
No, I didn't. I mean, I think it was just a way to, when you're so lost and you're a teenager, it was a way to connect with someone in a powerful way. You know, and we're all searching at that time to connect with people, and it's just a really powerful way to do it. And, you know, I really believe that, you know, masturbation is a key element in you know, women empowering themselves at that age, because, you know, I'm friends with a lot of people who were sexually active during high school, and I know, you know, almost all of them did not have orgasms until usually college age for women.
And that's important for pleasure reasons, or because it puts them in a different relationship to sexuality?
Well, I think in a way it's kind of linked to self-esteem, in that, you know, there's a power issue there, and there's also like a being able to satisfy yourself issue. And I think that men learn that at an earlier age than women do, and I don't really know why.
But there it is, and we see the patterns of behavior in high school. Brenda, we're nearing the end of our time here, but thank you very much for your call. Lynn Ponton, there's kind of a vote from Brenda for the perspective we're raising earlier, saying women be empowered.
I think certainly that women need to have some of the opportunity that men have had. But I want to go back and just emphasize one point. I think rather than saying no, I think what Mark might be saying about sexuality is we really need to have more conversations with our young people about sexual behavior. And in this regard, your show is really an excellent example of that, Tom. We really need to have more interchange and really more opportunity to hear from young people and converse and share ideas about sexuality.
Denny Patton, we've just got a minute left here. Your call is not for education in the middle ground. It's all the way to abstinence. Why not filling in a fuller picture? Do you think it just doesn't work practically, or does it come back to religion?
Well, I have three teenagers right now, and I work, you know, I have teenagers in my home constantly.
Yeah.
And anybody who knows anything about teenagers knows you cannot give them a mixed message. You can't say to them, the best behavior for you really would be to not have sex until a later age. But because we believe you're going to, we're going to teach you how to have sex. You couldn't do that with driving a car. You can't do that with drugs. You can't do that with cigarettes. You definitely can't do that with sex. So my point is this. Let the safe sex people teach safe sex in the schools, and then let those people come to our program, which is what they do, and we'll talk to them about abstinence. So they've gotten the message about condoms, contraception, and now we'll talk to them about abstinence, and they make the choice. And so that's our point. Let's have, as Mark was saying, let's have it all out there. But whatever you do well, do it well.
Denny, we tried to do that tonight. At this point, we're out of time. We appreciate your being with us. Denny Patton, president of Silver Ring Thing, an abstinence organization nationally. Lynn Ponton from the University of California in San Francisco, thanks so much for joining us tonight, Lynn. And Mark O'Connell with me in the studio, psychologist, instructor at Harvard Medical School, author of The Good Father. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
In a moment, the upper Midwest is invaded by owls. This is On Point. owls have invaded Minnesota and the upper Midwest. Thousands of the wide-eyed birds that normally inhabit the boreal forest of northern Canada have swooped down into the United States. The eruption, as it's called by scientists, has been driven by a plummeting food supply in the north. Cold, wet weather has made it a bad year for red-backed and meadow voles, a favorite food of great gray owls. Some people have reported seeing hundreds of owls in a single day. Jim Lind is an avian ecologist with the University of Minnesota's Natural Resources Research Institute in Duluth. In this radio diary, he says Minnesota is abuzz over the invading owls.
It's really caused a really big stir in the birding community and also just in the general public. This is happening on such a big scale, and the birds are so visible and so obvious. They're hunting in these roadside areas, so people just driving on their way to work are seeing large numbers of owls. Some people have never seen these owls. So not just the birding community, but just the general public has picked up on it. It's turned into a real big point of conversation for just your average person. The birding listservs are buzzing with people sending in their reports of seeing 100 or 200 great gray owls in a day, and so it's drawn in lots and lots of people from not just other parts of Minnesota, but other parts of the Midwest and even other parts of the country. Some people have come from overseas to see this. It's such a once-in-a-lifetime event. We've had reports of at least 500 great gray owls that have been hit by vehicles in Minnesota. The reason that they are more prone to being hit by vehicles is that they fly very low to the ground. They don't have a lot of peripheral vision. Everyone has seen pictures of owls, how they rotate their heads almost all the way around. That's because they can't move their eyes and their sockets very much. So they, when they're looking at something, they don't have a real wide peripheral vision, and so they're focused on their prey or they're focused on the spot that they're flying to, and they aren't paying attention to a vehicle flying down the road. Great gray owls are enormous. They're very imposing. They're about 2.5 feet tall, and they have a wingspan of about 5 feet, and they have yellow eyes and a little white neckband, and just an average year. We'll have maybe 30 or 40 sightings of great gray owls in northern Minnesota that get reported. During a typical eruption year, we'll have maybe 200-300 birds that get seen between, say, late October and late March. Now, in this eruption in Minnesota, we don't have a great handle on the exact numbers, but we figure it's somewhere between 2,500 and 3,000 individual different great gray owls that have been seen in the state. So it's on a much, much larger scale than has ever happened in recorded ornithological history in Minnesota, I guess.
What a sound. Jim Lind is an avian ecologist with the University of Minnesota's Natural Resources Research Institute in Duluth. Special thanks to Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology for providing the sounds of the great gray owl. Aren't they great? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.